Listen, the birds sing. Listen, the bells ring. All the living are dead, and the dead are all living. The war is over, and we are beginning.
Chapter 9. Natasha gets invited to Thanksgiving. Steve's still not sure how it happens, but they're drinking smoothies at the little shop a block away from Times Square after morning training. She just looks so sad as she talks about being alone with Clint in his rat-infested flop, eating pizza and getting drunk just like every other Thursday. He's not sure if it's her not-quite-genuine pout, the way she keeps texting him terrible old man jokes, or Rachel gently, but constantly, encouraging him to make friends his own age. "But you're my age, Rachel. Technically I'm older than you." "Rachel." "Rachel, stop laughing. I'm just saying I was born before you. It's not funny." "You're just going to give yourself more wrinkles carrying on like that. Frankly, it's behaviour unbecoming of a woman your age." "Really, Rachel, stop laughing." One moment he's got a mouthful of smoothie and a diehard conviction that his two worlds, S.H.I.E.L.D. and Brooklyn, do not mix. And the next he's inviting both her and Clint over for the holiday. Natasha lets out a girlish squeal before she says, "Yes, we absolutely will be there, bright and early. What should we bring?" "Anything you want to eat, I guess. We're not doing the traditional fare, so if you want, I don't know, pumpkin pie or something, you gotta bring it yourself." The nurse for the kids and the girl's caretaker, Mia, is Puerto Rican, and she's doing Puerto Rican this year. "Okay," says Natasha. "I'll bring something Russian, really make this a global affair. Also, there's gonna be kids there. The 7 who live at the home permanently, the 11 waiting on foster homes, and I guess anyone who gets placed there in the meantime. So, you know, cool it on the assassin talk." "No blood and bullets, got it. I'll make sure Clint won't tell that story where he shot that guy through each eyeball when he was diving off a roof to escape. But I must say, the kids would love that story." "Rachel won't." Natasha's eyes go wide, as if getting Rachel to like her is her most pressing concern, rather than whatever matter of national security she's going to discuss when she meets with the higher-ups after this smoothie break. "No assassin talk," she agrees. "Oh, and let Beck talk to you about why Thanksgiving is a bullshit holiday and genocide of the American Indian. She makes some great points. Really, you'll learn a lot. Or at least I did." Natasha fights a smile. "Okay." Steve takes a deep breath. Rachel and Beck are going to adore Natasha. They'll be amused by Clint. The kids are going to love having not one but three Avengers join them for dinner. Really, the whole thing will go great, and there is no reason to stress about it. Maybe, if he keeps repeating all of that on loop in his brain, he'll actually stop stressing about it. "Thank you, Steve," Natasha says, quietly, leaning across the table to squeeze his arm. She stands and sucks up the last dregs of her smoothie, the slurping sound making Steve wince. It's too cold for smoothies, but Steve runs hot, and nothing he's seen yet seems too cold for Natasha. She glances at the counter of the little smoothie shop, and looks like she's seriously considering getting another one. "You want the rest of mine?" he offers. Natasha leans down to take a sip, and grimaces. "Ew, blueberries," she says. "Gross." "Who doesn't like blueberries?" "Not all of us grew up worshipping the good old red, white, and blueberries, Cap." She laughs at her own bad joke as she walks out the door. Steve considers getting one of those tweeter things, just so he can tell the world that the Black Widow, in addition to being able to kill someone 3 times her size with just her fingers, thinks terrible puns are hilarious and has an endless supply of old man jokes. He wonders if anyone would believe it. Once a week, he tries to make it to the tower to have lunch with Tony. Usually, Tony is vastly unaware that it's the middle of the day and not the middle of the night, And every time Steve's dropped in, there's been at least one new Iron Man suit in Tony's lab, adding to the ever-growing collection. This time, there are 2.5 editions. But I just ate dinner, Cap. Tony pushes his goggles up on top of his head before he gets the blowtorch off. A couple sparks land in his hair, but Tony doesn't notice. "If by just you mean 12 hours ago," drawls Jarvis from the ceiling. "And if by dinner you mean a package of ramen noodles, dry, then yes, you did just eat dinner, sir." Tony rolls his eyes. "I'm not hungry, Capsicle. Now, unless you want to unbreak my heart by moving back into the beautiful suite I painstakingly constructed and decorated just for you, then you can get lost." Every week there are more robot suits, and every week Tony Stark looks a little worse. The bags under his eyes get bigger and darker. Today, they're a nice, deep purple. And Steve would think someone punched Tony. A completely understandable impulse. If he hadn't been around to see them get progressively darker. Steve never got to come home from the war with his fellow soldiers, but he imagines that a fair few of them look like Tony does now. One of his oldest memories is of some drunk in the gutter, looking pathetic as anything, and his ma giving him a few coins on their way to church, even though they absolutely could not afford such generosity. "He fought in the war," she murmured when Steve asked why she bothered. Not all of them came home as easily as George. Some came home sick. Tony looks sick. His hair is as greasy as the tank top he's wearing. He's wild-eyed, skittish. His cheeks are getting gaunt and hollow. "Where's Pepper?" Steve asks. "How the hell should I know?" "Tony, come on." "Singapore, maybe? Or Hong Kong? Dubai? Cali-fucking-fornia? Her schedule is really impossible. She's got my company to run, after all." He turns on the blowtorch again, but doesn't actually blowtorch anything. "Do you want to come to Thanksgiving?" Steve asks, even though when he opened his mouth, he had every intention of suggesting the Indian restaurant around the corner. They've got a buffet for lunch, and are too polite to charge him extra, even though he eats enough for 3 normal people. He makes sure to tip them 200%, because he can do that now. Last week he had no intention of bringing anyone from his new life home with him. Now he's going around inviting all the Avengers who live on this planet to Thanksgiving. They seem to need it, and Steve sure as hell doesn't have another way to help Tony. He's barely managing to get himself out of bed, most mornings. Tony turns off the blowtorch and stops moving for the first time since Steve stepped into the lab. "Am I really cracking up, or did you just invite me to your beloved borough? Your sacred streets. Brooklyn, oh Brooklyn. Your Brooklyn." Steve says, running his hand through his hair. He tries to move his fingers through bangs that Shield trimmed off him months ago. "Clint and Natasha are coming, so I'll invite Bruce, too." Tony scoffs. "Bruce doesn't celebrate Thanksgiving." "He might want to come and talk to Beck about that. There'll be Puerto Rican food. And something Russian." "This is for real? This is a real invite into the inner sanctum of Steve? Wow, Rogers. I thought you were here just to drag me to that Indian place. You know they refuse to serve me more than 2 alcoholic beverages. They cut me off at 2 alcoholic beverages, even when I offered to pay their rent for 6 months. "I'm still dragging you to that Indian place," Steve says. "But I'm also inviting you to Thanksgiving." "Well, it has been a good few years since I saw Mrs. Barnes and Mrs. Barnes." "That's Dr. and Mrs. Barnes to you, Tony." "The professor and her wife were around some when I was growing up, you know? Rachel got her big break designing my mum and her fancy friend's ball gowns. You know how much money I've dumped into that home of theirs? A lot, my friend. I guess I could eat food in Brooklyn again. It would make my dead mum proud." "So," Steve says, blinking rapidly. "Is that a yes?" "You can pencil me in. Now, are we having Indian food or what? I'm pre-gaming this meal, given their frankly insulting drink limit." '1939. Britain, Steve says, listing off countries on his fingers. France, Austria, New Zealand, even Canada's declared war on Germany now. The war's already made it across the Atlantic. No proclamations of neutrality from Roosevelt are going to change that. Eventually, we'll have to take sides. You're too eager for a fight, replies George Barnes. He sips his wine, this third glass going down quicker than the first and the second. Steve's still nursing his first. He's started to equate drunkenness with Sully's and touching Bucky all the time, so it's best to refrain today. Always with you. George waggles a finger in Steve's direction. Always so eager for a fight. You wouldn't be so eager if you knew what a war actually looks like, up close. Maybe, Steve agrees. But I also know that what Hitler is doing ain't right, and that he's going to keep doing it until someone stands up and forces him to stop. What, and you don't think all those countries you just listed will be enough? No, I don't, Steve says. This is the calmest conversation he's had about the war since the Nazis took Poland. There have been yelling matches in the bar that led to Sully actually kicking people out, and when Steve tagged along with Peter to meet up with his socialist friends at a bar in Harlem, the night nearly devolved into fisticuffs. So far the arguments are all pro-neutrality versus pro-joining the war against the Nazis. He hasn't had the misfortune to run into any Bund and their ilk. If he does, he'll probably get into some fisticuffs himself. But George is calm as always. Calm like he was when he tried to help Steve make sense of the last World War, when Steve really got interested in the conflict that killed his father when he was 12. Today, Steve and Bucky step through the front door of the Barnes' house for the first time in 3 years, Rachel tagging along too. This time, they had to knock, and Winnie took their coats like she would when greeting any old guests. Everyone was uncomfortably polite. Calm was about the last thing he thought George Barnes would be, when he was mentally preparing for this whole ridiculous day. In fact, when Bucky agreed to invite their sweethearts to Thanksgiving at the Barnes house, an invitation that Bucky attempted to avoid for weeks, until Winnie threatened to come down to Brooklyn Heights and track down the girls herself, Steve thought the whole thing would be the most uncomfortable afternoon of his life. And there has been tension since they got here, of course. First, when Bucky explained that Zelda would not be joining them for dinner, as her parents came to the city from Jersey for a surprise visit just last night. Winnie glared like she's never glared before. She also was a little wary of Rachel's typical loud enthusiasm, but George's face lit up when Rachel uncovered a casserole dish full of kugel, and a smile from her husband was enough to win over Winnie, too. Bucky and George remain another source of tension. They shared an awkward handshake and greeting, but haven't exchanged any actual words yet. They keep stealing glances at each other. Bucky will frown at his father when George is turned away, and George will stare at Bucky with longing when Bucky laughs with Hank in the next room. Steve hasn't quite figured out how to make it happen, but his goal for the holiday is now to get the two of them in the same room and talking. Despite a few uncomfortable moments, being in the Barnes house is the same as it's always been. The twins are buzzing with energy, their games getting a little wild here and there, but they settle down again with a quiet word from George or a silent glare from Winnie. Winnie is in the kitchen, attempting as always to teach Rebecca something useful about cooking, only now they're joined by Rachel, too, who's right at home behind a stove. The biggest surprise is George. Bucky's always made it sound like George was the reason they had to leave. He's more disappointed, and angrier, with his father than his mother, and Steve always assumed that George has hated them both for years. Instead, he's still just George Barnes, quiet but not shy, Winnie's partner rather than head of the household. Smart and articulate when he does decide to speak, slightly overwhelmed by the big personalities of his children, but happier when he's around them just the same. Rumour has it that before George went off to fight in the First World War, he was a lot like Bucky. Winnie's always said that she'd never met someone half as charming as George Barnes, that he made her laugh till her stomach hurt and swept her off her feet all at once. He came back from the war quiet. And it's the new war that he's talking to Steve about now, just like he's been talking to Steve about politics since Steve was far too young to really understand what it all meant. How much land did Hitler steal before the rest of Europe declared war? Steve asks. They should have stopped him in the beginning, and waiting made them weak. It'd be over much quicker if we helped them. Maybe. George drinks some more wine. But Britain and the rest made their bed. Hitler is their monster, with their reparations after the First War, and now Chamberlain letting him run amok for so long. Let Europe handle itself for once. George. Steve says Bucky's father's name for the first time in years. He told himself that he'd say Mr. Barnes instead, that he'd be distant and cold to George, but polite. Whatever George did before he kicked them out, it hurt Bucky more than anything else, and Steve wanted to punish him for it. He thought George would make it easy. He thought he'd be angry or cruel or more silent than usual. Instead, he's just the same, the closest thing Steve ever had to a father himself, and so Steve calls him George without thinking. Steve takes a deep breath and continues. He's our monster too. Eugenics started here, and we had a hand in those reparations. Plus, Rachel's still got family in Poland, some in Kiev. Great aunts and uncles and cousins. People she's never actually met except through letters. There's got to be what? A couple million Jews in Poland alone? What's going to happen to them? George flinches, and it makes Steve's stomach drop. He's never even seen George flinch in a boxing ring, back in the day when he'd tag along to the gym to watch George spar with Bucky's uncles. But Steve's words do it. Sorry, Steve says. No, replies George, shaking his head and finishing his wine. Steve leans forward, picking up the bottle on the coffee table to refill the glass. It's a point worth making. And America has been good for the Jews, but not that good. You heard of the MS St. Louis, German ocean liner? No. Well, it leaves Germany last spring, full of nearly 1,000 Jewish refugees. It gets to Cuba at the end of May. They are turned away. So they set their sights on America, on Florida, only 90 miles away. And guess what? They're turned away, Steve says, heart sinking. And the same when they go north to Canada. They are turned away. There are no saviors for the Jews in the Americas. It's got to be better than Hitler, right? Steve suddenly sounds too young to his own ears, and too desperate. Yes, perhaps. Or maybe so many will be slaughtered in this new war, caught in the crossfire no matter what America does. That's what the old one was like. A slaughtering. Steve thinks of the picture of his father in his uniform. It's the one with the silver frame in need of polishing, taken right before he shipped out. Just a couple of months later, he died choking on mustard gas. It's still in the trunk under the beds, never unpacked when they moved into the apartment, because Steve's stomach always takes a turn when he sees it. Steve will never stop being amazed by how calm George can talk about this new war, even though he came back from the last one so quiet. He can talk about it, has always talked about it. When so many other fathers in the neighborhood continue to drink themselves stupid, or dead, just to get out of even thinking about it. It's dangerous for my people everywhere, you know? George continues. And you're right, it's only gotten more dangerous with Hitler in charge. It's selfish, really. I'm selfish. Steve, I nearly cried in relief when Roosevelt said we'll stay neutral. Because I'd rather Europe be more dangerous for my people than have my son be the one to stand up to Hitler. Steve shivers, goosebumps suddenly breaking out on his arms. He never thought about it quite like that before. Steve would go over there in a heartbeat if he could. He's imagined himself free of asthma and scoliosis and a bad heart, being a soldier and fighting for what's right. But he wants Bucky nowhere near a war. In the next room, someone puts on music, and Bucky swings Hannah into his arms. She stands on his feet even though she's too big for it now, and Bucky slides them around with the wood floor beneath his socks, both laughing loud and free. It'll be boys just like Bucky, George murmurs. He looks so much like his son in this moment, Steve can't meet his eye. If it comes to it, they'll destroy boys just like Bucky, but not you. What right would I have to sit it out while other men are dying? You wouldn't have a choice, Steve. They won't take you. And you should be thankful for it. Steve spared the need to reply when Bucky demands he come throw around a baseball in the street before it's time to eat. So, where's the old country for you? Rachel asks when they're all seated at the table, plates heaping with food. Usually I can tell with the last names, but I don't think Barnes is Jewish. She looks between Bucky and George, where they're seated on the other end of the table. Winnie puts Steve as far from Bucky as possible, the seating arrangement very intentional. George glances at Bucky, but he's got his head down, steadily eating his way through turkey. This used to be one of Bucky's favourite stories to tell. He'd say, "And they changed our last name, just like that. Can you believe that some clerk could just change somebody's last name, just like that?" Steve could jump in, explain the story behind the name himself, but he's feeling distinctly less chatty since his conversation with George. Both the revelation that if the US goes to war like Steve thinks it should, Bucky will have to go to war too, and George's easy and casual conviction that Steve would never be doing it himself, have left him shaken. For a painful moment, Rachel's cheerful demeanour slips, and she squeezes Steve's hand under the table. No one speaks, and it looks like not even Rachel's cheery optimism will be able to salvage the meal. Steve should really say something, just to save Rachel the embarrassment. But then George clears his throat and wipes his lips with his napkin. "Well, it wasn't Barnes, not before Ellis Island," he replies. "Ah," Rachel smiles. "One of those names." "Yes. Barngoltz was deemed too foreign and too complicated for the Americans to learn. So when my father came through from Russia in 97, they jotted it down as Barnes. Americans are well acquainted with Barnes. This is an agrarian nation, you know." That gets a snort out of Bucky, but he shoves some more turkey into his mouth to cover up his amusement. God forbid Bucky find anything his father says amusing. Steve sighs and pokes at his mashed potatoes. "So you were born here," Rachel says. "Yes, my parents actually met on the trip over." "Very romantic." That gets a snort out of Winnie at the other head of the table. All heads swivel in her direction and she shrugs. "I've never heard the cramped, damp quarters of smelly, slow-moving ocean liners called romantic before." "Oh, I don't know," Rachel replies. "Two young people on a journey into the unknown find each other and start their lives in the new world together. Romantic. What about you, Mrs. Barnes? Were you born here? Isn't Buchanan Scottish?" So Winnie gets to talk about getting on a boat days before the Easter Rebellion, and her stoic Scottish father, who never wanted anything to do with his Irish wife and all the children they had when he wasn't paying attention. It's such familiar territory. These are stories Winnie used to tell them after she tucked them into bed, when Steve used to sleep over on nights his ma had shifts at the hospital. Steve relaxes slightly. He even smiles when Winnie tells that story of how seasick her brother Tommy was on the way over. He relaxes some more when the twins start singing some dirty song in Gaelic Tommy taught them, Beck egging them on and Winnie scolding them. By the time their plates are licked clean, everyone's stuffed and sated, it almost feels like any other holiday spent around the Barnes dining room table. Except for Bucky. He barely says a word. Sully's is closed for the holiday, but when they get off the trolley and walk over to drop Rachel off for the night, there is light coming through the drawn curtains and they can hear music thrumming. "Sully was supposed to be with Frank's family for dinner," Rachel says. "Guess he got back early." When they step inside and get the door closed behind them, Steve lets out a breath he's been holding since George said, "And you should be thankful for it." As if all his health issues would keep him safe instead of killing him by the time he turns 30, if about a dozen separate doctors are to be believed. Dinner was fine. For a few moments there, Steve actually felt like he had his family back. Really? The day could not have gone better, and he honestly expected it to end worse. With tears, maybe. The whole day was fine. But Rachel sat close to Steve's side, while Bucky was on the opposite end of the table, and it felt wrong. Rachel touched him so casually, and it made Winnie smile. But Steve worried his pumpkin pie might come right back up, and not because of the ulcers. Winnie teased them about tying the knot, and Steve couldn't even pretend to smile. He's always hated lying, but it's worse when it's the Barnes he's lying to. And he's still so angry that lying is necessary at all, to finally get them permission to come home. Without Rachel on his arm, they still wouldn't be welcome in the house they grew up in. Walking into a room full of regulars at Sully's is a relief. They are allowed to be their whole selves here. No elaborate lies necessary for them to be welcome in this room. And Steve can breathe again. Beside him, Rachel lets out a delighted laugh when she sees Sully. She slips out of her coat, dumps it on a stool, and then hops up on the bar, swinging her legs up and over before landing on the far side. She throws her arms around Sully, who smiles back indulgently, patting her hair. "How was it?" demands Peter. He laughed at them for about 10 years, when Bucky told the whole story of how they were roped into inviting the girls to Thanksgiving, but now he looks genuinely concerned. Steve glances over his shoulder at Bucky's face. Eyes blank, jaw clenched, slight furrow between his eyebrows, and understands this concern. "Could have been worse," Bucky shrugs. "Rachel's a lifesaver," Steve says. "Every potential awkward moment, she got the conversation started up again. We'd never have made it past the introductions without her." From behind the bar, Rachel blows him a kiss, even as she continues to tell Sully about the day. "Oh, and my ma is partial to Christmas weddings," Bucky grimaces. "You know, in case that affects any plans I may or may not have for Zelda. She also thinks Steve and Rachel would have handsome children." Steve frowns up at Bucky. "She said that." "Yup." "Jesus Christ." Peter nods in sympathy. "Let me buy you fellas a drink. Seems like you could use it." "Thanks, but I'm done with booze for the night," Bucky replies. "Really?" asks Steve. "You have your drink, Stevie, and then let me take you home." So Steve leans up against the bar next to Peter, drinking his beer and filling Peter in on how strange all of the almost normalcy of the evening seemed. Bucky doesn't say much, but he stays pressed along Steve's back, wrapping his arms around Steve's waist and nosing at Steve's hairline. "Bucky," he whispers on the walk home, "you ever going to tell me exactly what happened in 36? "No." It sounds more like a habit than a staunch conviction that Steve must never know the exact circumstances that led them getting thrown out on the streets. "They found out, right? I can't imagine how, but they found us out." Bucky sighs, but he doesn't deny it. "I always thought it was your pop, like he got real nasty with you, like he started to hate us both when he found out, or something, like he disowned you." "I never said that." "You never said anything," Steve snaps. Bucky closes his eyes, just for a second, but the hurt expression is enough to make Steve regret his tone. It's been a long, hard day, despite how okay it was, and there's no need to make it worse by yelling at Bucky. "He loves you a lot, you know. Did you talk to him at all?" Bucky sighs. "He asked if we needed money, while the rest of you were playing cards before dessert." "That's it." Bucky clenches his jaw and nods. "We were talking about the war," Steve says. Bucky snorts. "Great." "And about how there's no one to protect the Jews in Poland and Eastern Europe." "Even better." "He said he's selfish, because he'd rather leave Europe and its Jewry to its fate than have you be the one sent over there to fight Hitler." "Jesus." Bucky stops and presses the palms of his hands to his eyes. Steve counts to 10, knowing that Bucky's counting too, and then Bucky drops his hands. "Ma's been trying to get me to pick up shifts with Tata at the garage since she found out about Zelda." "Yeah?" Yeah. Don't think I could handle being alone with him like that, though. Well, what about the gym? Your uncles will be around for that. And you'll get to punch Tommy. You love punching Uncle Tommy. Bucky gnaws on his lip for a few seconds. You think they still go spar on Tuesdays? Buck, says Steve, laughing a little. They've been sparring on Tuesdays since before I met you. He really said all that? Yeah, Buck, he sure did. Bucky takes a deep breath. It sounds shaky, like it should be coming from Steve's asthma-prone lungs instead of his own healthy chest. I'm still so fucking mad at him. For whatever happened that you won't tell me about. Right. And I swear he's still so mad at me, even if he doesn't want me to get blown up in Europe. Steve doesn't say anything, just watches as Bucky approaches with his head hanging low, shuffling his feet. He doesn't stop until there's only an inch of space between them. When Bucky drops his forehead to rest it on Steve's, Steve closes his eyes and breathes deep, hoping that Bucky will breathe with him. That always helps when Steve's choking for air, when he can hear Bucky breathing deep. When did all this get so complicated, huh? Bucky whispers. Oh, probably about the time I got my first Woody, because he grew 3 inches in 2 months and had a jawline all of a sudden. Or maybe when I was getting myself off to how your fingers looked wrapped around pieces of charcoal when I was about 14. 14? Steve opens his eyes to see Bucky grinning a little. Wow, you got me beat. Guess this is all your fault then, huh? That actually makes Bucky laugh, but he keeps his eyes closed and is back to sighing and frowning a moment later. Can we go home now? He whispers. Steve takes his hand and leads him in the direction of the tenement, but he's got to drop it a second later, out of fear of running into someone they know when they turn around the next corner. The moment they're through the front door, Bucky's on him, big hands wrapped around Steve's hips. The lock, Steve says, breathing hot and salty against Bucky's mouth. Let me... I took care of it. No. Steve struggles to turn away. Let me. You know I can't enjoy it if I don't check the lock myself. Bucky groans and walks them both back towards the door, grumbling about Steve being a paranoid little punk. He doesn't stop touching Steve, not as they lumber to the front door, or when Steve gets his fingers on the deadbolt. They didn't even manage to turn the lights on, so Steve can't see it, but he knows the familiar up position means locked, and he sinks back against Bucky, relieved. It's locked. Bucky breathes into his hair. It's locked. We're safe. Come on, sweetheart. Please. Okay, Steve says. He turns in Bucky's arms, his fingers finding his shirt buttons in the dark. He kisses Bucky, deep and heady. Okay. Bucky's got better eyes than Steve, and the meager light getting into the kitchen through the front window is enough for him to navigate their way back to the bedroom when Steve pushes on his chest and makes him walk them that way. Steve gets him out of his shirt by the refrigerator. His belt hits the floor in the doorway to the bedroom. Bucky gets tripped up on his own pants when Steve gets them around his knees, but they're close enough to the bed that Steve just pushes him down to sit on the end. Bucky's completely naked when Steve hops up to straddle his lap. He groans when Steve rolls his hips, and Steve's never seen him this shaky. Beneath him, Bucky's whole body quakes, and Steve searches out his mouth again. One brief, hard kiss, and then Bucky drops his forehead to Steve's collarbone. Buck? Steve runs his fingers through Bucky's hair. You okay? Sure. Steve chuckles, pressing a kiss to Bucky's sweaty temple. You sound real sure about that sure, buddy. Bucky swallows. Steve can feel his throat work against his shoulder. Wanna be a pal and fuck me now? Steve freezes, his fingers tight in Bucky's hair. You sure? He manages eventually. They don't do this very often, not with Steve's tendency to get overexhausted after about 2 minutes. And when they do, it's usually Steve taking it, as he also has a tendency to get demanding about things he likes, and he really likes it. Bucky's usually a little more cautious about the whole thing, or a lot more drunk. I mean, you sound kinda upset. You sure? Sure, I'm sure. James Buchanan. Bucky lifts his head and kisses Steve, sweet and gentle. Please, he says. Please, sweetheart. That's 3 pleases and 2 sweethearts. Bucky's voice is rough, like he really needs it. And Steve says, okay. His hands are gentle. Bucky doesn't rush him, just lies where Steve places him, gazing up and panting. Bucky's hips arch off the bed, and he covers his mouth with his hand, trying to keep quiet. Exhaustion be damned. Steve could do this forever, could touch Bucky forever. But Bucky's hips are moving in earnest now, his hands not enough to stifle his moaning. Steve hitches Bucky's legs up around his waist and presses into him. God. Bucky groans, his hands running down the length of Steve's crooked spine. God, I love you. He doesn't have enough breath to move and speak, so he says it back with his body. Steve usually passes out right after, overcome with fatigue. But sometimes Bucky gets chatty after he comes, and Steve wants to know what he has to say tonight. So he forces his eyes to stay open, even if he can barely make out the line of Bucky's nose in their windowless bedroom. They're lying on their sides, facing each other. I was sitting there, burning with envy, he finally says, as Steve's eyelids droop lower and lower. Huh? At dinner. At dinner? I wasn't jealous when I thought you had a real shot at marrying her, Bucky whispers. Like this is a bigger secret than what they just got finished doing. But I was burning with it today when she got to sit near you and laugh with you, when it was my family thinking you had a real shot at marrying her. Oh, Bucky. For a second there, watching you two at the other end of the table, that seemed like real life, like I'd dreamed up everything else, this home and you here with me and the bar. You didn't. That part of visiting your family, that's the lie. That's fake. This is real. Bucky takes a deep breath. You gotta remind me sometimes, I think. I still don't quite believe it could be this good for people like us. Steve kisses him, wraps both arms around his neck and pulls him close. I'll remind you. I'm always gonna be here to remind you. I ain't going anywhere.